From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, two people who are trying to educate others about AIDS. Rashida Hassan has taken her crusade into crack houses and onto the street corners where prostitutes work. Richard Jennings is working in Hollywood, where actors who are HIV positive can be shut out by the entertainment industry. Also today, we talk with Indian-born filmmaker Meera Nair. Her new movie is the story of an African-American who's never been to Africa, and his affair with an African-Indian who's never been to India. It stars Denzel Washington. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new primetime cartoon series, Capital Critters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. At the Mideast peace talks, Israel's foreign minister rejected a suggestion that Palestinian exiles be included in the talks on regional issues. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The ground rules for the Middle East peace conference, now in its third round, are that only Palestinians from the occupied territories can take part. But today, after the Palestinians boycotted the talks, Secretary of State Baker suggested that Palestinians living outside the territories could participate in a set of multilateral talks on refugees. Israeli Foreign Minister Levy said no, he would tolerate no change of rules now. Levy said if the Palestinian delegation included so-called diaspora Palestinians, the Israelis would refuse to meet with them. Palestinian leaders want their expanded delegation to be included at all levels of the peace conference. The Moscow talks, meant to begin negotiations on such regional issues as water rights and arms control, end tomorrow. This is Mike Schuster in Moscow.
The United Nations Security Council has postponed a decision on whether or not to continue economic sanctions against Iraq. The Council was expected to continue the sanctions imposed on Iraq after its invasion of Kuwait. The Council President, British Ambassador Sir David Hannay, said that some of the Council members wanted more time to study issues such as Iraq's cooperation on weapons inspections. Hannay said that the members are concerned with Iraq's failure to comply with UN demands for the destruction of weapons and the return of Kuwaiti prisoners and property. President Bush and British Prime Minister John Major have urged that the sanctions be maintained as long as Saddam Hussein is in power. In the Turkish city of Istanbul, a police commissioner has died after being shot by two gunmen. The commissioner was shot getting into his car, and his daughter was injured. Jonathan Rugman reports.
The father and his 18-year-old daughter were getting into a car outside their house in an Istanbul suburb when the attack happened. The policeman died on the way to the hospital. His daughter escaped with a wound in the leg. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, but the most likely candidates are Dev Sol, a left-wing revolutionary group, or the PKK, a group of committed Kurds fighting Turkish security forces for their own Kurdish state. Last month, 12 people died in an Istanbul clothing store after a firebomb attack by PKK supporters. The group has been spreading its terror campaign to Turkish cities. The PKK recently bombed Istanbul's most famous tourist haunt, the Grand Bazaar. For National Public Radio, this is Jonathan Rugman in Ankara.
Stock prices surged to a record closing today on the anticipation that President Bush's State of the Union address will outline new plans to stimulate the economy. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 32 points to close at 3,272.14, advances edged declines in heavy trading of 217 million shares. This is NPR. The Senate approved a Democratic-sponsored education bill today after rejecting President Bush's proposal to allow federal money to go to private schools. The measure passed by a vote of 92-6. The bill authorizes $850 million this year for block grants to the states to improve education. A computer hacker with a taste for art history has struck a Massachusetts company that produces personal computers. Bruce Gellerman of member station WBUR reports.
As many as 500 people who bought leading-edge personal computers in December may find out on March 6th that they've got a big problem. On that day, they'll turn on their computers and find it's been infected with a software virus that reminds them it's the 517th anniversary of Italian artist Michelangelo's birth. Craig Conrad is a spokesman for the Westboro, Massachusetts computer maker.
You don't get any information except the surprise Michelangelo might be on is on your system.
Conrad says a user discovered the infection, which may prove lethal or benign. 9.
It hasn't occurred, so nobody knows what damage will occur, if any damage will occur. Or it could be very simply a hoax where March 6 may come along and you may get something on your screen that says, Happy Birthday, Michelangelo, and that might be the effect of it.
Leading Edge will supply a software antidote to people who bought Michelangelo-infected computers. For National Public Radio, this is Bruce Gellerman in Boston.
Nicaragua announced today that it has rejected a Taiwanese bid to log more than 500,000 acres of rainforest on the country's Atlantic coast. The Taiwanese investment group had promised to inject $25 million into the area's economy and create 4,000 jobs with the first stage of the project. That would have had an enormous impact in an area where unemployment is estimated as high as 85%. The project drew strong opposition from local environmental groups, which enlisted international support to help defeat it. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This month, the AIDS epidemic passed another awful marker. Over 200,000 cases have now been reported in the U.S., according to the CDC. The percentage of cases among homosexual and bisexual men has dropped since 1989, but the percentage of cases among blacks and Hispanics and heterosexual IV drug users is up. Many experts believe that the reason AIDS is still proportionately on the rise among blacks, Hispanics, and drug users is that they have received less information about the disease. My guest Rashida Hassan is trying to change that. She's the co-founder and executive director of BABASHI, an acronym for Blacks Educating Blacks About Sexual Health Issues. BABASHI is based in Philadelphia and is considered one of the most successful grassroots organizations of its kind. Hassan first became an AIDS activist when she was a nurse practitioner in the field of epidemiology. She worked with an AIDS task force in Philadelphia, but by 1985 she decided the group wasn't reaching much beyond the gay white community.
There was, at that point, a strong unwillingness on the part of the gay community nationally to sort of relinquish AIDS to a broader public health perspective. And I understand very much that it was, aside from a devastating illness to the community, I mean, clearly the gay community has suffered tremendous losses as a result of this disease, but it also gave them a public forum for other gay rights issues. So there's a give and take with it. But what was clear to me is that when you look at how disease progresses through human populations, people who are least educated and are most socially and economically disadvantaged are often much more severely impacted by these kinds of illnesses.
Who specifically do you try to reach?
Well, BABASHI has had probably multi-phases of outreach efforts. One was to simply alert in general the minority populations, the African-American population specifically, since many of my clients and the constituents we would try to reach are African-American. We also try to target those that are most at risk and least likely to have information. So, you know, we see our intravenous drug users, people involved in sex trade. We also believe that young people, adolescents especially, are going to be at greatest risk and also have the least amount of information based on behaviors. And then we try to then fan out more generally into the community consciousness aware, you know, awareness raising.
I think it must be incredibly difficult to reach drug users, IV drug users who are in the high-risk group. Mm-hmm. When you started going to crack houses, how would you talk your way in? I mean, I'd imagine among the people who are very suspicious of letting in somebody who's not a user themselves is the people who run the house.
Well, that's true, but these are not strangers. I mean, we're familiar with people who do drugs in our community. We're familiar with people who run drug houses. I mean, they're somebody's brother or somebody's cousin, and, you know, you ask, well, who is this? This is Jimmy, you know. And you say, well, Jimmy, I understand that you might be familiar with some people who could use the information I have. I'd like to have a chance to talk. I talk to Jimmy. I might not go to the crack house the first time I meet Jimmy, but he gets to know me a little bit. He sees me around. He knows I'm out on the street passing out condoms, that I'm giving literature, that I've talked to a few people. After he's seen me for a few times, he's a little more comfortable with, oh, yeah, I know who that woman is. She's from BABASHI. I wear my little BABASHI badge, as my staff continues to do. once you've set up that kind of relationship, the next step is to say, well, I really would like to have an opportunity to talk to people who are active, you know. You think that's possible. And it's like, well, yeah, we could probably get you in. And you just trust that person to take you in to do it. It's not a matter of, you know, going up to somebody's door, knocking on the door and say, I understand you sell drugs here. I'd like to come and do some AIDS education. I mean, you really can't do it that way. But it does mean entering into sort of that world and being willing to exchange with the people.
Were drug users willing to listen?
Yes, if you got them just as they were going to make their fix, you know, take whatever
right,
drug
right
they
before.
Had right before, or as they were preparing to inject, you could get a message in. Your messages have to be short. We're not talking about a 45-minute lecture on AIDS, but while they're preparing, saying, you know, we want you to clean your needle with this. This is dilute alcohol or bleach, and we want you to, you know, clean through it three times, and you actually show them how to do it. They draw up their drugs after they've, you know, done whatever they need to do with them and inject them. We're talking about we've got to, you know, wash this out again now that you've used it. It's your needle. Keep it for yourself. And, you know, they'll listen for that. We're talking about 2-3 minutes of conversation, but you try to get back to them as often as possible.
I want to go back to the beginning of the group when you were still trying to figure out how to do this, mm-hmm. how to reach people who were not being reached mm-hmm. by AIDS education. And you decided you needed to reach people who worked in the sex trades. Mm-hmm. So what was your technique for finding them, talking to them, convincing them?
Well, it's never hard to find
the
sex trade areas in any major city. You just have to kind of drive around and look and see. I think the approach, again, is just to survey the area. I mean, I hung out with the ladies that worked the street in Philadelphia, and there's a couple of corners that, you know, we spent time on. Same kind of ideas before with drug users. You let them see you. You talk with them. You introduce yourself to them. It's not hard to strike up a conversation with people on the street. I'm always amazed at their willingness to exchange information. And so we just used that technique. I sat on the wall and talked while they worked, and you know said, well, you're at risk for sexually transmitted diseases, and have you heard about AIDS? And here's the way you could protect yourself. And then they would tell me things like, you can't get your customers to use condoms, or, you know, can you really get AIDS if you're only having oral sex? And, you know, well, then how do I protect myself in that way? And really talking about very personalized, again, issues around behavior change. And the women were willing to listen. You know, some of them took condoms, and some said they would use it. Some say they don't. If the issue was complicated by them also being drug users, that added another element that we needed to talk about. I don't find that any of these groups of people that we've really targeted, very focusedly targeted for AIDS education, are that difficult to talk to. They have concerns and fears about what they're doing, but they're doing whatever they're doing to survive. And we just can't judge that. I can't speak to, you know, whether they are good or bad or better people. I just tell them the information. If they choose to use it, they do. If they need more information, they'll call and say, you know, I want to talk to that woman that came in the jeans with the studs on her pants, or, you know, that kind of thing with it, until they get to know you.
Well, let me ask you, when if a prostitute says to you, well, what do I do if I can't get a customer to wear a condom, what advice can you give?
Well, you know, they have had in their experience a lot of different ways, I think, of getting customer cooperation. Some men won't use condoms. If they're having oral sex with a prostitute, the prostitute learns techniques of putting on a condom without them necessarily being aware of it. And we try to get other prostitutes who are familiar with that technique to teach them that. And I think that's been very successful in getting done. Sometimes some of them will say, well, you know, if we don't, then we can't have sex, or I won't perform certain types of acts for you if we can't use protection. So they have their methods of getting customers to be cooperative with it. Others are saying, you know, I've got to make the money. I'll take the risk, you know, and that's, again, just a reality of their survival methods.
Let me ask you a question I'm sure you've been asked by a lot of the people you've been trying to educate, which is, why do you care?
Well, you know, again, my entire life really has been around trying to give back to the African-American community. I was very fortunate to grow up during the time period of great civil activism, civil rights movement, had an opportunity to go to schools that were not all that excited about having African-Americans come and had an opportunity for education. I'm very steeped in African-American history and culture, and I love my community. I really do. And so going into issues that may seem tough for others is just recognizing the need for community survival. When you look at it from a survival mode, it does really strip away a lot of your fears about going ahead and getting what needs to be done. And nobody else is doing it. You know, that's the other concern that we have, that if we don't do it, why should we expect anyone else to?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rashida Hassan, and she's the co-founder of a group called BABASHI, which is an acronym for Blacks Educating Blacks About Sexual Health Issues. It's an AIDS group that's based in Philadelphia. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Rashida Hassan is my guest, the head of a group called BABASHI, Blacks Educating Blacks About Sexual Health Issues. I'm sure you've thought about this a lot, but what do you think are some of the reasons why there's a disproportionately high amount of AIDS in the Black community?
I think that it is solely based on the fact that the minority populations have not been well educated about HIV infection. It has not been presented in ways that make it personal, that much of the information that has been provided leaves questions, I think, for minority populations especially. We have no reason to trust government people with words about if you use condoms, you won't get AIDS. We have no reason to believe that anyone would want to help us in that historically there's been so much negativism associated with a lot of public health efforts. I have not had a single AIDS presentation go without the question, well, what about Tuskegee, which refers to the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. And so people remember that, however distorted.
You should explain what it is for listeners who don't know.
Basically, during immediately after World War I, many men in the area of Tuskegee, Alabama, were knowingly not treated for syphilis. They were observed and studied to essentially get the natural history of syphilis in the human body. These men suffered miserably, were not treated even when penicillin became available. The experiment went for more than 40 years.
And they thought they were being treated.
They attended clinics regularly. They were seen by medical people in an area where having medical care provided was so unusual and so rare that they were happy to participate in the program. It wasn't until I believe 1972, when it was really brought to light and there was a large investigation and that sort of thing. And for those that had survived or their families, there was a monetary settlement of about $20,000. But the devastation that it caused in that community and the memory that has lingered as a result of that experiment has left a very hostile feeling by many Blacks about public health issues and having people come in from the outside world and sort of invade them with this information.
Do you hear conspiracy theories a lot when you're out talking about AIDS? Conspiracy theories that AIDS has intentionally been spread in the Black community as a form of genocide?
Yes. That, unfortunately, as I say, is frequently the question I'm asked to give my opinion on. Do I think it's genocide? And as I tell them, I don't know, but if it is, it's succeeding, and it will succeed as long as we don't intervene to stop it. I really don't have time anymore to worry about whether it's a conspiracy or not. I'm sure that 30 or 40 or maybe 50 years, someone will write a book and tell us, you know, about their theories of whether it was a conspiracy or not. What I want to be clear about is that there are people available to read the book.
My guest is Rashida Hassan, and she's the head of BABASHI, a Philadelphia-based AIDS group. It's an acronym for Blacks Educating Blacks About Sexual Health Issues. How did Magic Johnson's telling us that he tested positive for HIV, what effect did that have on your group and on the kinds of phone calls you're getting, the kinds of questions you're being asked?
Well, I think overwhelming impact it comes to mind immediately. We do run a client services unit that does HIV antibody counseling and testing. And during the almost 2 weeks immediately after Magic Johnson's announcement, we tested more than 300 people. Many of them were women, many of them were young, and they were different. It was a different population than we've been seeing in the past.
Everybody's telling Magic Johnson what they think he should be doing
Yes.
to help educate about AIDS and to help get more government support for AIDS programs. Well, what would your suggestions be?
Well, I think that he's already done what I would like to see him do, and that's continue to speak about it, to be visible in the public eye. I don't want to see him tax himself so that he really is jeopardizing his own survival. But I think that making sure that he has opportunities to speak directly to the community, come to the community, come to Chicago, come to Philadelphia.
I'd like to know what you'd like to see President Bush do about AIDS.
I think I'd like to see him actually understand the AIDS epidemic. I don't believe that he has a very clear picture, or else he really is in incredible denial, and I'd like not to think that he's stupid. I think I'd like to see him attend some of the hospitals and recognize the tremendous burden hospitals are currently under in trying to care for people with AIDS, that it's not just research, that it really is about care and treatment and education. I'd like him to understand the impact of adolescent pregnancy and STDs and how it affects the AIDS epidemic and how it actually has become an integral part of the AIDS epidemic. I'd like to see him come out of the White House in October when the quilt returns to Washington and is spread out in front of the Washington Monument and the acres of land that it covers representing the thousands of people that have died from AIDS. I'd like to see him demonstrate some humanity in understanding and recognizing this epidemic is not only devastating America, but the world.
Rashida Hassan, thank you very much for talking with us.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
Rashida Hassan is the executive director of Babashi, which is based in Philadelphia. Misinformation about AIDS exists at every level of our society. In Hollywood, actors who are HIV positive are afraid if they go public, they'll never work again. The new group Hollywood Supports was created to fight AIDS discrimination and homophobia in Hollywood. The group was founded by Sid Sheinberg, president of MCA, and Barry Diller, CEO of Fox. My guest is the executive director of Hollywood Supports, Richard Jennings. He's a lawyer and gay activist. One focus of Hollywood Supports will be to work with film executives and producers to end discriminatory hiring practices. Producers feel they can't take the risk of hiring an actor who may get sick during filming, but according to Jennings, some producers are overreacting.
People too often have leapt to assumptions just because someone has tested positive or just because they are either gay or lesbian or presumed to be gay or lesbian, that if you're gay, you're part of this high-risk group and you may have AIDS, and so we're not going to hire you. And that's the sort of discrimination that's arbitrary and based on ignorance that we want to end.
So you think gays are staying even more carefully in the closet now because they're afraid if they come out, people will assume that they might be HIV positive?
I think there are many who are staying more in the closet these days because of that.
Do you think that the way AIDS has been handled in Hollywood is connected at all with the way homosexuality has been handled, with the history of homophobia in Hollywood?
I think that AIDS phobia is inextricably linked with homophobia, that we would not have had the stigmatization of people with AIDS that we have seen for the last 10 years in our society if we did not have the marginalization and stigmatization of people who are gay and lesbian. AIDS carries this connotation that that you know people who have it must be gay or must have gotten it through homosexual sex. And I think it's very important then to educate people about their stereotypes and their misinformation about homosexuality at the same time as we're educating them about AIDS. And I think Hollywood's portrayals of people with AIDS, which have been practically non-existent, have been interesting. We've seen a couple films last year there seemed to be a spate of films of people who were young who were dying of terminal illnesses, and those illnesses weren't AIDS, but it seemed as though they were using other illnesses as stand-ins for AIDS, because I think there's a great need in our society to deal with the trauma that we have all been undergoing, seeing young people being cut down in the prime of their lives by a disease that still is very much misunderstood.
Now, I had read that the actor Brad Davis, who died of AIDS, that when he was sick, he didn't use his name when he filed insurance forms because he didn't want anyone to know that he had AIDS because he was afraid mm-hmm. he'd never work again. Have you heard that from other people? Do you think that that's happening a lot now?
That has been a fairly common practice by people who have needed to get AIDS drugs. We have a situation where many insurers, when people put in for compensation for AIDS drugs, especially AZT as an example, the insurers will often notify the employers that the employee has been taking AZT, and then the employers put on notice that the person has AIDS. And in order to avoid people finding out, many within the entertainment industry, as well as other industries, have been either trying to find ways to pay for these very expensive treatments on their own, or you know, going without insurance, and it's been debilitating for people affected by AIDS.
Some people say that it's the closeted executives in Hollywood who are in a way the worst, because they're afraid if they did anything about homosexuality or gave a role to someone who was openly gay, they might be accused of being gay themselves. Do you think that that's true?
I think historically there has been a problem that the closet in Hollywood has been one of the worst stumbling blocks for getting gay and lesbian positive images on the screen. I think that was documented in Vito Russo's book, The Celluloid Closet, which is the best history I know of gay and lesbian portrayals on the screen. And I think that it's only recently begun to change. I think there are more people who are willing to greenlight gay and lesbian projects in Hollywood without being afraid that will, in other people's eyes, identify them as being gay or lesbian. And I have a lot of hope for the future.
I wonder how much faith you have in the American public. You know, like if somebody were to come out either about being gay or about having HIV or AIDS, a lot of their future would depend on how the American public reacted to them if there were someone in front of the camera, someone whose future really depends on being liked by the public. Do you think the public is ready yet? Are you optimistic about that?
I think the public has a lot more information now in the last few years, thanks to talk shows, thanks to some episodes that we've seen on TV lately. And I think if we look at the situation in Britain, where hopefully people are not all that much more enlightened than they are in this country, there were about 18 major stars, celebrities, producers, directors, as well as TV stars who came out in an open letter to the newspaper in Britain a year ago. And those people have continued to do very well in their careers and remained popular despite their disclosure that they're gay or lesbian.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Richard Jennings is the executive director of Hollywood Supports. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Meera Nair's 1988 film Salaam Bombay was about the homeless children of India. Nair was born and raised in India. Her new film, Mississippi Masala, was shot in the American South. It stars Denzel Washington as an African-American who falls in love with an Indian woman who grew up in Africa. Coming up, we talk with Nair about what unites and divides people of color in America. The Simpsons has made it safe to put animation in prime time. TV critic David Bianculli has a review of the new primetime animated series, Capital Critters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. One day after canceling his scheduled appointments, Russian President Boris Yeltsin was in southern Russia to meet with naval commanders. The Russian leader made a tour of the Black Sea Fleet, an object of controversy between Russia and Ukraine. Yeltsin's two-day visit to a southern port city was not announced until a day after he arrived. A spokesman said that Yeltsin made the trip in order to get ready for meetings next week with Western leaders concerning problems of nuclear security. The Russian president has dropped from sight several times since the failed August coup. In New York City, a UN Security Council official says that Iraq has still not met all of the conditions necessary for lifting of economic sanctions against it. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The Security Council met today for one of its periodic reviews of the trade sanctions, which forbid Iraq to sell oil or buy anything but food and medicine. Afterwards, Security Council President David Hanay of Britain told reporters no formal decision had been made about whether to continue sanctions, but he also said Iraq had still not met all of the conditions necessary for the embargo to be lifted.
There is very grave concern about a number of areas of Iraqi non-compliance, particularly over weapons of mass destruction, over detainees, Kuwaiti detainees, over the return of property, and over some financial issues.
Hanay said the council was very unhappy about an incident in Baghdad yesterday in which UN weapons inspectors were allegedly jostled by demonstrators while Iraqi police watched. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
In Capitol Hill, the House Ways and Means Committee has taken the first step toward providing an additional 13 weeks of unemployment benefits to people who have run out of jobless pay. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The new bill providing for an extension of unemployment benefits is moving fast through the Congress. The House is expected to pass the bill next week, and it could be passed by the Senate and sent to President Bush shortly after that. The extension would cost about $2.7 billion and would be paid for with a combination of existing funds and an acceleration of corporate tax collection. Last year, Congress passed legislation providing for an extra 13 or 20 weeks of jobless pay, but only after a long battle with the White House. This year, with unemployment stuck at around 7% and the president's approval ratings dropping, agreement on another extension of unemployment benefits is expected to come without a fight. The White House has already signaled President Bush's intention to sign a bill, and the president has said he plans to propose his own jobless benefit extension proposal during the State of the Union address tonight. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 32 points to close at 3,272.14. This is NPR News. In Poland, much of the nation's industry has been halted 5 days after Russia broke a barter agreement and turned off gas supplies. Factories across the nation have been burning only as much gas as needed to keep from damaging their machinery. The agreement guaranteed Poland natural gas and oil in return for food, coal, and medicine. But Russian President Boris Yeltsin signed a decree giving firms more independence and freeing those involved from their commitments to Poland. A leading Kuwaiti pro-democracy campaigner is accusing some Kuwaitis of selling affidavits to expatriates who want to stay in the country. The documents say that the person did not cooperate with Iraqi occupation forces. Some people are paying about $3,500 for these papers. Mike Theodula reports from Nicosia.
Expatriates and stateless residents seeking work in many public sector institutions
need an affidavit saying they didn't collaborate with Iraq during the seven-month occupation. According to Ahmed al-Rabai, a pro-democracy campaigner, the process has become corrupted. He says there's a market in these certificates. An affidavit stating you didn't collaborate can cost up to 1,000 dinars, he says. One stating you helped Kuwaiti citizens costs more, and the priciest are those saying you were in the resistance. It could mean some collaborators are buying their innocence, while innocent people, desperate to stay on in Kuwait to earn a living, or with no other place to go to, are being fleeced. Al-Rabai is urging the authorities to distinguish between genuine character witnesses and those who trade in affidavits. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
A New York Times CBS News poll finds that President Bush's approval rating has dropped to 43%, down from 88% after the Persian Gulf War. 46% of those surveyed approved the president's conduct of foreign policy, compared to 46 who disapproved.
This is Fresh Air. You may know my guest Mira Nair as the director of the 1988 movie Salaam Bombay. It was about homeless children in Bombay, and it starred children who Nair found on the streets. Nair is an Indian filmmaker who studied theater and acting in Delhi and then came to the States to study at Harvard. Her new film, Mississippi Masala, is about an Indian woman who was born and raised in Uganda but flees with her parents to America during the rule of Idi Amin. They settle in Mississippi, where they manage an Indian-owned motel. The girl, now a 24-year-old woman, falls in love with an African-American played by Denzel Washington. Sure, they're both people of color, but her family is upset that she's getting involved with someone who's not an Indian. In this scene, her father, played by Roshan Seth, is confronted by Denzel Washington.
I see. So you think I ain't good enough for your daughter, is that it?
No, that's not it. Mina is free to love anyone, to live as she chooses. I respect her freedom. But that does not absolve me of my responsibility as a father.
Well, no disrespect to you, sir, but she's a grown woman and we care for each other very much. Now, I think that's all there is to it.
You know, once I was like both of you, I thought I could change the world, be different. But the world is not so quick to change. Mina is my only child. I don't want her to go through the same struggle as I did.
Struggle? Look, I'm a black man born and raised in Mississippi. Ain't a damn thing you can tell me about struggle.
What do you know about my...
No, I know. I know. I know you and your folks can come down here from God knows where and be about as black as the ace of spades, and as soon as you get here, you start acting white and treating us like we your doormats. I know that you and your daughter ain't but a few shades from this right here. That I know.
Mississippi Masala was filmed in the U.S. and in Uganda. I asked Mira Nair what gave her the idea of making a movie about the relationship between an African-American man who had never been to Africa and an African-Indian woman who had never been to India.
The seed of the idea really was exploring the relationship between a black and brown, you know, black and brown communities. And one always thinks of racism as between black and white. And I know, coming from India as I do, with no interaction really with any kind of African community growing up, that there is still within our own community a consciousness of color, of fair being beautiful and of dark not being so beautiful. And coming to America as a student, I found being brown, being Indian, gave me a kind of freedom and flexibility to move freely between the black and white communities. And despite that, I felt always some kind of invisible lines always sort of rearing their heads at some point. And this gave me the original idea to explore this theme of race between black and brown. But then reading up more about it, I came upon a wonderful article on the Asian expulsion from Uganda. And we are... I mean, I meet so many Asians who look so much like me who've never been to India, you know, sort of the quintessential Asian diaspora from Guyana or West Indies or Africa or wherever. And that is extraordinary to me to meet people who are so Indian in even the way they grew up, but yet kind of frozen in their Indianness, who think of India as a kind of homeland but who've never been there. And I think the parallel to the whole African-American situation here is a very real one. And the Asian expulsion from Uganda, when Idi Amin threw out 80,000 Asians practically overnight after three generations of living there, seemed to me a point in history where these tensions reached a very sort of head, which became the leap-off point for this movie.
I'll confess that until I saw your movie, I didn't realize that there had been so many Indians living in Uganda and that they were then later expelled. What brought them there in the first place?
Well, the British, as you know, colonized India in the 1800s, and the British also colonized major parts of East Africa. When they colonized East Africa, they wanted to build a railway through major parts of East Africa and found that neither the British technicians could stand the tropical conditions and nor did the African indigenous Africans there have the skill to do this. So they shipped in as indentured laborers, much as they did in the West Indies, laborers from India. So in the late 1800s, a number of Indians were brought into East Africa as indentured labor. Most of these Indians left back for India, but about 25% of them stayed on. That was the first ground, you know, the first ground was laid in this way for Indians to begin their lives there. And as they settled down, they sort of sent for wives from India and the network sort of grew, the community grew.
It strikes me that the cast that you assembled for your movie is as multicultural as the story of the movie itself. You have African-American actors and Indian-American actors and Indian actors and actors from Uganda. and I'm wondering if the acting styles from each of these cultures was really different and if you had to find some way of taking these disparate styles and bringing them together for the movie.
Well, for me, masala is a collection of Indian spices of different colors. It means, for me, I conceived of the entire film as a masala, the casting, the music, the locales, you know, and the themes, of course. The actors that I assembled particularly for their particularity, if I may. I didn't want to flatten anybody out and make them sort of a generic American or a generic sort of flattened out character, because I believe life isn't like that. So I reveled in the sort of soap opera acting tradition that one of the Indian actors came from the legendary song and dance tradition that the mother Sharmila Tagore comes from, you know, from the non-acting tradition of Sarita Chowdhury, who plays the major role opposite Denzel Washington. For me, this was the challenge was to keep the particularity of each character and each human being that I had invited to be a part of this masala and yet create a seamless universe. I wasn't interested in sort of Alec Guinness playing an Indian, like Passage to India, you know. It was very exciting to pull in actors of various traditions that I had admired for so long and, you know, ask them to be part of this masala world.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mira Nair, and her new movie is called Mississippi Masala. She's also the director of Salaam Bombay. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Film director Mira Nair is my guest. You were talking before about being between black and white when you moved to America, that you could kind of go, you were part of neither culture, but you were comfortable in both, and you had a kind of entrance into both as an Indian. And you had said somewhere that when you came to America, you instinctually felt in solidarity with black people. What gave you that instinctual sense of solidarity?
The warmth, you know. I really felt the physicality, the communal, you know, the sort of communal living of people knowing, you know, having large sort of extended kinships, whether they be real families or whatever, but a feeling of living with a lot of people. And just the sort of living from, you know, the visceral living. I mean, I could really sense a human connection. I responded to that emotion very much. That's the kind of way we live in India. And being together with people, the physicality between us, the fact that you don't have a sense of being alone in the world, that there are people who know your business. And I like that.
You know, one of your earlier films was a documentary made in India about how amniocentesis has led to selective abortion in India, where female fetuses are selected to be aborted in many families because girls aren't as valuable in the culture, in part because you need a dowry for the girl to get married, and the girl leaves and goes to the husband's family. There's no one to carry on the family name.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if when you were growing up, you were aware of the fact that girls seem to have less of a value than boys in that respect.
Well, I came from a fairly liberal family, and I have two older brothers, and I'm the youngest, and then the only daughter. And for me, it was actually a great advantage. One, because I was encouraged as much as the boys were. And secondly, because there was a much greater pressure on the boys to be this, that, or the other. And that pressure was not really placed on me, even while I was encouraged in every other, you know, in every aspect of schooling and growing up. Since that pressure was not on me, I was left to really do what I liked to do and what I wanted to do. And since I wanted to, I was an actress in an amateur level in India. That was fairly unusual, but my mother still encouraged me to pursue it. So coupled with not really having to get all the good grades, I could still be allowed to, develop my interest in theater, which really was the springboard for being a filmmaker now. So I did come from a fairly unusual background in that respect.
You said that when you came to America, you felt this instinctual solidarity with African Americans. I'm wondering if you felt that African-Americans felt that same instinctual solidarity with you, or if it was more one-sided than that.
Well, I don't know. You'll have to ask them. But I do remember feeling this solidarity. I felt sometimes a tension amongst black women when black men would consider me a possible partner for them, or, you know, like I was not a white person, I was a third world sister. And that was threatening in some ways to the African-American women around. And so I remember my friends really being more from Jamaica and the West Indies more than African-American women, my women friends, and we were very close. So I remember that sort of sense of resentment sometimes, you know.
Is race and culture still an issue for you now in terms of fitting in? You've been living in America for a long time. You've been making movies here. Are you self-conscious about being from another country now?
Being from another country is always a strong part of me. I see it really as my strength, not as anything to be to work around. Initially, when I graduated from college and I went back and forth to India, it used to be a source of confusion to me. Should I move back? Should I stay here? Should I place my roots? All those kinds of things. Then I began to use that confusion in my work, and then I began to get used to the fluidity of moving back and forth. But I think, as Nehru said, you have to be very local to be universal. And I feel very, very much rooted in India in a certain way. In fact, I moved out of, I don't live in New York anymore. I don't live in the States anymore.
Oh.
in a everyday sense of the term, you know.
Where are you living?
I live in Uganda now.
You're kidding. Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I do.
Why did you move to Uganda?
Well, I sort of fell in love with the country and with one person, and I lived there as a result. And it's not quite India, but we are sort of setting a base in Uganda and in India this year, and I expect to be moving back and forth between Uganda and India.
So is the person who you fell in love with an Indian in Uganda?
You're right.
Wow, so you're in the middle of so many different cultures.
Right, now I'm a genuine masala.
And you met this person making the movie?
Right, right. So, you know, so now I'm kind of everywhere. But Uganda is very similar to India in so many ways, and it makes me, I feel just so much more at home there, you know. I was sort of tired of the, I mean, New York is a great place to work in, but not such a great place to live in. And I've since had a child, and I just don't expect to raise a kid in Manhattan. No, thank you. So
did you want to raise the child in Uganda?
In India, really. So we're keeping that open. But I'm in the middle of a lot of things right now.
I was wondering if you were still in touch with any of the kids who were your actors in Salaam Bombay, which is a movie about homeless children in Bombay, and you used children who were really homeless to star in it.
Yes, I'm in touch with almost all the children from Salaam Bombay. We set up, you know, from the profits of the movie, a part of the profits, Salaam Balak Trust, which is a non-profit organization in India that is funding learning centers for street kids, not just the kids from Salaam Bombay, but for other kids like them. And now we have three such centers in Bombay and Delhi and Orissa. We made the movie based on these extensive workshops with street kids who then performed themselves, acted, you know, as close as possible to their lives on screen. And these workshops were not just designed to teach a kid how to act or anything, but they were fairly holistic in their design, you know, between providing literacy and coordination and some sort of creative expression, things like that. And these learning centers that we are running now for the last 3 years are sort of takeoffs on that workshop design. In fact, we are using all the benefits from the premieres of Mississippi Masala all over the world to keep the Salaam Balak Trust running. Some of the kids from Salaam Bombay are in these centers, but they are really much older now, and each one is really pursuing what he or she wished to do at that time.
What is the leading actor from Salaam Bombay doing now?
Shafiq Sayed, who played Chai Pao, the tea boy, is now working in Delhi in a film studio, a small film studio, as an assistant camera person, you know, learning how to use the camera and lights. And he has dinner with my mother every Wednesday night.
Oh, that's great.
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Meera Nair directed the new film, Mississippi Masala. It opens February 5th. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Well, Linda, tonight is the much-anticipated State of the Union address by President Bush. What do you have on that?
We're going to anticipate the president a little bit, Terry, and we're going to check on the State of the Union ourselves, the state of several communities, one in Southern California, one's on the west side of Chicago, one's a suburb of Houston, and then a community in Queens, to see what the state of those neighborhoods is. Then we also are going to consider the president's concerns about a health plan, which is included in his budget and presumably also in the message, which Republicans in Congress have some problems with. In other news, Middle East peace talks in Moscow.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week, ABC is presenting a new program. It's a primetime cartoon series, and they really want to make sure you see it. They're showing an episode tonight, another episode tomorrow, and a third episode this Saturday. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
It's been 2 years now since The Simpsons got their own primetime cartoon show on Fox, and it's taken that long for another network to generate a primetime animated show of its own. CBS ran promos a year ago for its Family Dog cartoon series, produced by Steven Spielberg, but that still hasn't shown up. There were problems with both production and the quality of animation, so they've literally gone back to the drawing board. Tonight, though, another famous producer named Steven comes to bat with his primetime cartoon series. He's Steven Bochco, co-creator of Hill Street Blues, L.A. Law, Doogie Howser M.D., Cop Rock, and Civil Wars. His new series is called Capital Critters, and it's about a bunch of mice, rats, roaches, and other vermin who live deep inside the White House. Everything that goes on there is seen from their perspective, and there are more than enough rats and pests, the non-political types I mean, to allow these capital critters to wage war with one another, wreck their environment, stage covert operations, and do other stuff just like the humans they see through the cracks in the walls. The difference is, the mice and rats learn their lessons and change their ways. It's a wonderful idea for a cartoon series, and it works very well with kids, at least my kids, for whom I road tested the first four episodes. But if you're looking for a sophisticated, full-family type of entertainment, Capital Critters comes up short. Written by Night Court producer Nat Malden, Capital Critters isn't as clever as The Simpsons, or as daring as other Bochco productions, or as deep as the animated film version of Watership Down. Its nearest cartoon relative, actually, is Jim Henson's Fraggle Rock. That show, too, had little creatures who lived inside the walls, ventured into the human world outside, and dealt with their own complex society of animals inside. But from an adult perspective, Capital Critters is pretty thin. The only really appealing hook for me was listening to the voice of Bobcat Goldthwait, who plays an escaped lab rat who's been shot full of every chemical known to man, or mouse. He's kind of like a four-legged Reverend Jim from Taxi, and his lines and characterization are the only unpredictable thing about this show. Here's a scene where Goldthwait's character accompanies two buddies on a basement food raid. Charlie Adler provides the voice of the tough-talking rat, and the voice of the newly arrived field mouse named Max, the star of the show, is provided by Neil Patrick Harris, the title star of Doogie Howser.
I can't believe this. I mean, back in Nebraska, we just go out in the field and pick corn.
Yeah, sounds really exciting. Come on, give me a hand here.
I yearn for the country life, Max. I've often thought that the bucolic pastoral setting would be more conducive to my writing.
What do you write, Muggle?
My name. I hope to be done soon.
If that sounds funny, consider this. That's the best moment from 2 hours worth of shows. And if it doesn't sound funny, consider that same fact even more carefully. Kids will like it, and I have no problem allowing or encouraging them to watch it. As for me, though, I'll stick with new episodes of The Simpsons and my tape collection of Rocky and Bullwinkle.
David Bianculli is TV critic for The New York Post. Fresh Air's reviews and interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy, Roberta Shurrock, and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, environmental racism. Sociologist Robert Bullard says a disproportionate number of toxic dumps, landfills, and incinerators are ending up in Black and Hispanic neighborhoods. It's led to a new branch of the environmental movement focusing on race, class, and environmental quality. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
National Public Radio. That's beginning at 9 o'clock tonight on 91 FM. The forecast overnight, partly